You're listening to the Holistic Nootropics Podcast, your home for holistic, evidence-based cognitive enhancement strategies. On this episode,
it's like, well, you know, if you're at your job 10 hours a day and you're unhappy, we can do all this other stuff to support you, but it certainly doesn't solve the problem of you not living your best life and what you're meant to do.
And now your host, Eric Levi.
Hey, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Holistic Nootropics Podcast, where we discuss holistic cognitive enhancement. My name is Eric, the Holistic A-Hole, and in this podcast, I'm interviewing Chris Hanvey. Chris is an integrative psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner in Asheville, North Carolina, who offers holistic services to all age groups through her private practice, Asheville Holistic Healthcare. She strives to treat the whole person by getting to the root cause of their disease. Chris began in nursing in 1987 as a registered nurse. She has an advanced study certification degree in complementary and integrative therapies from Drexel University that she obtained in 2009. Chris graduated from Case Western Reserve University in 2010 as an advanced practice nurse practitioner. She is certified as an herbalist after graduating from the Blue Ridge School of Herbal Medicine in 2018. Additionally, she has training through the Institute of Functional Medicine. She is a Reiki master and Phoenix Rising yoga therapist, yoga and meditation teacher. So in this episode, me and Chris go deep into how she uses different holistic tools and modalities to help people enhance their cognition in her personal practice. Again, she has the traditional, kind of Western medicine registered nurse degree, but then over the years, she's spent her time obtaining all of this education in things like meditation and breath work and Phoenix Rising yoga therapy, which I didn't even know what that was until we talked. And now I'm convinced that is a powerful tool. So we talk about all of that, how she helps people using these holistic practices. We even talk about genetics, how she uses genetic readouts to really understand a person's genetic blueprint to help guide her into how she prescribes different medications and different supplements, and understanding a person's genome is so important in that. So we discussed that. So I know you guys are going to love this podcast. Before we jump into the podcast, I just want to throw a quick reminder. If you are new to the podcast, please remember to subscribe, go on over to iTunes, leave a 5-star review, put a few lines of how much you love the podcast in there. Even if you don't love it, you're going to love it. Put some kind words in your review. And for more on all things nootropics, all things cognitive enhancement, head on over to holisticnootropics.com. We have the show notes to this podcast over there, along with an entire library full of different nootropic supplements, brain-boosting supplements, along with guides on the best supplements to use for different issues like ADHD, social anxiety. We even talk about nootropics that are great with yoga, different genetics. So I know you guys are going to love that resource. So go on over to holisticnootropics.com and join the newsletter so you can be up to date every time we publish new content. So with no further ado, everybody, please enjoy my conversation today with Chris Hanvey.
I think that one of the first things that I try to do when I first meet someone is find a connection with them, because I think that is something that we lack in general right now, is a sense of connection. So I try to meet people where they're at and to find a resonance where they can relate to me and I can relate to them, while staying true to who I authentically am. And I think that's really an important piece of being a practitioner, is connecting to someone and letting them know that they're heard. I think in nursing, we are taught to do that. We're taught to connect and to take like a Rogerian, Carl Rogers approach to connecting to someone and letting them know that they're heard. So I think that as nurses, we are trained to do that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, cause that's such an important thing, you know, I think especially in mental health, you know, maybe that's part of the equation that's really missing in traditional medicine, which is, you know, not to say that this is what, you know, your field is, but in a traditional doctor's practice, it's you have 10 to 15 minutes with a patient, and then how can you really understand the depth of a person's experience and what is truly at the root of what they're going through in that short a time? So, you know, of course there's people, of course people are prescribed so many medications because you have to give the, you have to have a solution for somebody. And if you don't really know, you have to just go with the best thing you can think of.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, that's definitely a challenge when, you know, payers are reimbursing for a certain amount of time, or there's some investment in kind of hurrying the process along. But that being said, I definitely have taken my children to pediatricians that we've had a very small, discrete amount of time together. And I felt that connection with that practitioner, and my child has felt it. Conversely, I rarely need, fortunately, to go to the doctors, but I've had some experience over the last 10 years of going to practitioners where I haven't found that they've connected with me or even looked me in the eye sometimes. And so I think even eye contact, goes a long way, and shaking hands and letting someone know that you're the partner, you know, your partner's together in care, rather than, they're the almighty seer and tell you what you need.
In your practice, then, what would you say are the most common, I guess, pathologies or symptoms or issues that you see, be it in, do you work mostly with adults or with kids, or is it like a mix of both?
I'd say it's 75% adults to 25% children. I see the gamut of, you know, bipolar disorder, anxiety, addiction, recovery, people in recovery, depression.
When you're working with somebody, because you do a lot of different things, you know, you kind of blend those two worlds of the holistic and the kind of traditional allopathic. But, you know, when it comes to something like bipolar versus maybe more kind of regular depression, how do you determine what treatment is better for which one?
Yeah, I guess I take a risk-benefit approach to care, and you know, you have to look at the level of acuity. So medication is going to have a higher level of risk, but a bigger bang for your buck if someone's, you know, very acute, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So in other words, if someone shows up and they're in a mania or a manic condition or treatment-resistant depression, I'm certainly not going to look at supplements to start. You know, I'm going to look at medication. So it's very dependent on the person, the level of acuity, and really being a partner in care with them and saying, you know, here's our options. You know, this is what I think our options are. You know, what are your thoughts about them? And the options are going to vary depending on the condition and level of acuity and their preference.
Sure. And so then at what point do you, because you do these different things, like you do, it looks like meditation, you know, you'll introduce meditation to people, you introduce yoga, you introduce even Reiki. I would imagine probably diet you probably discuss with people. You know, at what point do you start bringing these different therapies in to working with people like this?
You know, if someone shows up for the first time, I'm going to certainly take a very thorough history and find out, you know, what's going on with them and, you know, what kind of family history, et cetera. And then from there, I'll decide, you know, what kind of things I want to add to the palette, if that makes sense. Like, we start with genetic testing to look at medications, and do they have a methylfolate issue? Trouble getting folic acid into the brain in a usable form. So we can talk about, you know, treatment options and cost. So genetic testing might be done in the first session. I might send them home with a food testing kit where they send that off, and we can look at food intolerances at the, you know, at the follow-up appointment. And then at the end, I often like to do some kind of meditation or just, you know, even breath work. And I would say that happens over 50% of the time, where I'm really trying to connect with them, you know, in terms of how can they find the soothing place within, or how can I help do some energetic healing with them?
You know, when I personally started getting into meditation, making those connections of the breath really does control the emotions, you know, and you start to, I think that's such a powerful tool, you know, for somebody experiencing depression, anxiety, even, you know, focus issues. It's like when you start to understand that and see that, well, when I feel anxious or when I feel down, my breath physically, my body physically changes, my posture physically changes. You know, I think in a lot of people that can be a real profound difference.
Right. The breath is everything. It's really what keeps us here. I think we forget that, you know, it's the matter of life and death. If, you know, if we're breathing, and conscious breathing is so crucial, you know, especially with things like panic. You know, if people can learn to do practices when they're not having a panic attack, they'll have those tools when they're having an anxiety attack or a panic attack. And interestingly, when I was in nursing school, getting my RN back in the 80s, I was in a teaching hospital doing a rotation, and there was a woman who was she was hyperventilating, and they were ready to intubate this woman. And, you know, I was a student working with her, and I can remember, you know, sitting with her and, you know, doing some breath practices, and she calmed down. And, you know, I think that the resident was a little disappointed that they didn't get a chance to intubate her, but it was really just a matter of her having a panic attack and hyperventilating and her needing to just kind of catch her breath and find her breath and the rhythm of her breath.
So I wonder, you know, kind of like as you were talking about that, I started thinking about that almost kind of being like a learned habit. Maybe there's something deep seated in you, that stimulus reaction. And the emotion, is it the emotion comes before the breathing, or the breathing comes before the emotion?
Yeah. And I think then that's where we get into the interconnectedness between the mind and the body. I think that it works both ways, and they feed off of each other. I think that when we are afraid, we start to breathe very shallow, in a shallow way. And then when we do that, it exacerbates our sense of fear and our lack of oxygenation. So I think that they're interconnected. I'm receiving network chiropractic care right now, and they talk about emotion is using motion to release emotion, and using the breath to facilitate the release of what you're holding in your body.
Yeah. It's really like a feedback loop, right? It's like one thing and then it compounds. I've been over the last couple of years, but really in the last year, really focusing on trying to get myself into like a deep squat, into physically being able to squat, because I've had tight hips my whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've had this crazy goal that I wanted to, you know, be able to go to the gym and do better squats. And, you know, I've been doing yoga but the squat, my hips have always been so tight. And I've noticed that since I've been able to start getting deeper in the squat and then hold it for longer, I mean, literally when you stand up after being in a deep squat for a long time, I mean, it feels just like emotions start falling off of you. Like some people I know do yoga and they'll get into a pigeon pose, which is a good hip opener, and they'll start crying in the pigeon pose because it's such an emotional release.
And in the Phoenix Rising tradition, you know, there is a saying that we hold our issues in our tissues. And there's some that would say that in our hips, we hold, you know, our connection to others. So it's just interesting that when you hold that position for a period of time and then you get up, you release what you're holding in your tissues.
So yeah, I love that. I love that so much. You know, another big thing for me personally was when I started learning about posture. And my wife would always, because she's a yoga teacher, and she would always tell me that I walk with a slouch. And I was like, what are you talking about? I walk normal. I never even knew that, right? This is a couple of years ago. And then when I started doing yoga and then working on a lot of like back bends and different openers, and then, you know, I have had these yoga teachers who talk about when you walk, you know, you look above the horizon. And that's another game changer, in my opinion, you know, just actually looking up versus looking down while you walk. The way you walk explains so much of the emotion you carry, the issues in the tissue.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that trying to be and act normal puts us at a disservice, because I think if we did more stretching and more moving and more releasing of audible breath, and that's what I try to teach my clients to do, like an audible sigh, like, you know, just to release that energy that we're holding through breath and through movement. It's okay to do that and to look not okay, to be okay.
So I'm curious, because you were talking about the Phoenix Rising yoga. What is that exactly?
So it's a modality developed by a man named Michael Lee, who he lived at Kripalu, and every morning he would go to yoga and there would be a man crying. And he said to the man one day, and he cried every time he was in triangle pose. And he said to this gentleman, you know, I notice you're crying every day when you're in triangle pose. What's happening for you? And the guy said, I don't know. And so Michael, this was kind of like an inspiration for him to develop this process, this yoga therapy process, where we connected with what's happening in the body. So it's very much a client directive type of modality that you check in with a client to start, and then you put them in assisted yoga postures, restorative postures, and you dialogue with them on what's happened. And you use reflective dialoguing, where you repeat back what they say so they can hear, you know, what's going on with them. And it's very different than counseling, because counseling you would interpret and maybe, you know, make suggestions or recommendations, or use, you know, more interactive dialoguing. But this is more just being a witness to what's happening. And then at the end of the session, you check in with them on what happened during the session. Does it reflect what they're experiencing in their life? And if not, is this something they want to see more of? And people come away with these wonderful pearls that, you know, they can take with them. And they also have, you know, provided this release from what they're holding in the body. So it's a really cool modality.
Wow. I would imagine you could probably get some real interesting emotions and thoughts out of people by talking to them in yoga poses. I know I've been, you know, like, I hate the plow pose. Hate it. That's where, you know, you lay on the ground, you put your legs over your head and you try to almost touch your feet to the ground. I hate that pose so much. And I mean, I would imagine you probably hear some pretty terrible things come out of people when they're, I don't know how uncomfortable the poses are for those people, but I know if I'm in a plow pose, I'm going to probably say some pretty awful things about whoever or whatever I'm thinking about.
There's called what's called the soft edge, where you want to put someone in a pose where they're at an edge that's an emotional edge rather than a physical edge, where that, you know, where there's a lot of physical discomfort that really isn't good for their body, versus pushing that edge, that psychological edge, where they're really kind of, challenged to take a look at what's going on in the body mind.
Yeah. And that's such an interesting advantage over laying somebody on a couch and asking them questions. I would imagine you get a whole different, category of things that bubble up to the surface.
Yes, because I think when you're sitting on a couch, or, you know, people don't lie on couches anymore, but when you're sitting there, or in the past when people were lying on a couch, you can really be in your head. You can get very heady. Mm-hmm. But when you're challenged to go into the body has a wisdom, or has, you know, these pearls that we're not aware of. And there's, you know, they come up and people are like, whoa. And, you know, it's really interesting about Phoenix Rising yoga therapy is the pearls that I might see or venture to guess are not what clients come up with. Mm. And, you know, you just learn to not project your thinking onto them, because their experience is very unique and the pearls that they have are very specific to them.
Yeah. Wow. This is the first time I've heard about this. It seems like an incredible tool. You had mentioned a little bit earlier about genetic testing, and I've been super interested in genetic testing. So I'm a nutritional therapy practitioner, and I use genetic testing in my practice. And it's the field of genomics, especially nutrigenomics. I'm still fairly new to it. But to understand this idea that there are genes that correlate to nutrients and SNPs that correlate to nutrients, and SNPs aren't bad, they're just the programming. And, you know, how deep into that do you get in your practice? Because I know I've heard a number of practitioners kind of go over the spectrum. There's some people who that's where they start and where they finish. And then there's some people who are a little skeptical on the results they get from that. And I'm wondering where you kind of land within that.
Yeah. So I started doing genetic testing. I want to say it was in 2013. So I've been doing it, you know, a long time comparatively to a lot of providers. And I'm pretty steeped into it. I mainly use or have used two companies, GeneSight and Genomind. And they both do mainly pharmacogenomics, which looks at the right drug for the right person. And, you know, it's certainly not, you know, a bullseye when you do the testing, but it certainly gives you a little bit, illuminates, you know, what's going on with a person from a genetic perspective a little bit more than you'd have if you didn't do the testing. For example, there are biomarkers for SSRI medication. Mm-hmm. And would someone be a good fit for these types of medications, which are pretty much the mainstay of what we use for depression, at least, you know, first line. Mm-hmm. So if someone is not a good fit, you know, I often see it on the back end because, you know, they've already been on a lot of these meds and they haven't worked. And then we do the testing and you can see anecdotally, you have a biomarker that these meds might not be a good fit. But they also look at other things like pharmacokinetics, which is how proficient the liver is in metabolizing medications based on the cytochrome 450 pathways. Mm-hmm. And each med is broken down by a different, you know, pathway. So for example, with Lexapro, it's broken down by cytochrome 2C19. You might be slow at breaking down Lexapro, and Prozac is cytochrome 2D6. Mainly. So you might be fast with breaking down, faster breaking down Prozac. So it's not like some people say, oh, I'm a fast metabolizer. Well, it's usually specific to a certain pathway. Mm-hmm. And so it looks at many different markers, including methylfolate,
yep.
Which might fall into, you know, more the realm you're speaking of, you know, does someone have a good ability to take in a synthetic B vitamin and methylate, you know, convert it to a usable form in the body. So when we look at fortification of foods, you know, everything's fortified. If someone's not a good methylator, they're, you know, really going to be at a detriment when they eat those foods because it's kind of going to sit in the bloodstream, but it's not going to be able to be used on a cellular level. So I kind of liken the variant, the methylfolate variant, to not having a full hazmat suit on. But the positive with that is people who aren't good methylators usually are sensitive people. Mm-hmm. So they know, they kind of naturally know or organically know what to stay away from.
Hey, what's up? It's Eric. Wanted to take a second to break away from the podcast to tell you about an amazing nootropic product that I love. It's called MindLab Pro. Whether you're a nootropic newbie or you're an experienced nootropic user, MindLab Pro is a powerful pre-formulated nootropic stack. I almost refer to it kind of like a nootropic multivitamin because it's got 11 research-backed, evidence-based ingredients, all of which I love, all of which fit in line with what we're about here at holisticnootropics.com. You get 11 amazing nootropic ingredients, each kind of doing their own thing. You get citicoline. Citicoline is the most bioavailable form of choline you're going to get. It easily crosses the blood-brain barrier and boosts your levels of acetylcholine, which is the precursor to dopamine. It's what helps boost your brain's ability to focus, remember things, and you're going to get more brain energy, motivation, memory. You also get phosphatidylserine, which is one of my personal favorite nootropic supplements. Phosphatidylserine, it helps modulate the HPA axis. It helps take your brain from feeling that fight or flight that so many of us feel so often and helps kind of chill that out a little bit, helps kind of regulate it back to what it's supposed to be, which is not constantly panicking about every trigger in your environment all the time. It helps kind of reel it in a little bit so you're not pumping cortisol all throughout the day. And the big thing, MindLab Pro's formulation of phosphatidylserine is it's derived from sunflower. So much phosphatidylserine, I'd say most phosphatidylserine out there in the supplement market is derived from soy, and so many people have soy sensitivities. This is from sunflower, so it's a much better quality form of phosphatidylserine. You're also getting lion's mane mushroom, which is probably one of the most popular mushroom forms in the nootropic community. You're going to help brain regeneration. You're going to increase your memory, increase mood, increase focus. And then you get these great nootropic herbs like Bacopa monnieri, which is, this is 24% bacosides, which means it's highly bioavailable. You get rhodiola rosea, which is an adaptogen, which is going to give you kind of a boost while also not driving your HPA axis crazy. And then you also get pine bark extract, which provides more blood flow to the brain, higher levels of antioxidants in the brain. And then you get L-theanine, which is, if you're wary of nootropics or if you love nootropics, L-theanine is good for everybody because it puts you in that alpha brainwave state. That's where all the creativity comes from. That's where your brain is really sharp. That's where you're almost in a flow state. That's what L-theanine is great for, but it doesn't make you tired. That's what I love about L-theanine. And then you also get N-acetyl L-tyrosine, which is going to help boost your levels of dopamine in the brain. It's going to help you feel motivated, feel excited. It's going to boost your overall mood. And it's N-acetyl L-tyrosine, which is the more bioavailable form of tyrosine. And then the big thing you get from MindLab Pro is you get the B vitamin cofactors. So you get B6, B9, B12. These are so important because people are, again, are taking these different nootropics. And the problem is you can put all the ingredients in the pot you want, but if you don't turn the pot, if you don't turn on the stove and then mix it all together, you don't get the final product that you're looking for in cognitive enhancement. That's what the B vitamins do. They stir the pot, they turn on the heat, they make it all work. You know, B6 literally puts different nutrients and puts different molecules together. B12 is a methyl donor. It's what helps make methylation happen in the cells of your body, in your body's DNA. It's what actually turns on all the good genes that you need. And so many people are B vitamin deficient, be it because of genetics or a lot of people because it's diet or environmental factors. So MindLab Pro, again, giving you so many amazing ingredients that are good for your body. It's GMO free, it's soy free, it's gluten free, it's allergen free, it's caffeine free. It's made in a vegan friendly capsule. Again, doesn't have all of the crap, all the additives and fillers and excipients that you find in so many different products. And if you buy it from us here at holisticnootropics.com, we have a great deal with MindLab Pro where they're giving you 3 months of MindLab Pro plus 1 month free extra. So you're actually getting 4 months of MindLab Pro for the price of 3, and then you get free shipping anywhere in the world. So if you're in the US, if you're in Asia, if you're in South America, Canada, wherever you are, they can ship all around the world. Again, 4 boxes for the price of 3. Go on over to holisticnootropics.com/MindLab Pro to get this deal. Again, holisticnootropics.com/MindLab Pro. Boost your brain, boost your life. Let's get back to the podcast. So I'm curious. I like to get geeky a little bit with this, but I'm curious what the difference is, because I've had a number of conversations about this very thing and about the use of methylfolate versus folic acid. And, you know, I've heard both sides. I've heard that there is no difference, and then I've heard there's a profound difference. Right. Personally, I've used the 5-MTHF form of methylfolate. So, and to be honest, I don't even know if I'm supposed to be using that anymore. So if you can maybe dive a little bit into the difference between those two and then how you know what you're supposed to use for those.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, back in 2013, carte blanche, I recommended if someone had a variant that they take unopposed methylfolate. I don't want to mention the nutraceutical, but there was a specific nutraceutical that was prescription. And I kind of got burned on a few people and that it didn't agree with them. And, you know, then I went to a conference by a group of people who worked with Dr. Lynch, Benjamin Lynch.
Yep.
And what I learned at the conference, and it was probably around 2014, 2013, was that was not really the best approach to really make sure that you support all the B cofactors, not just methylfolate. And if someone has a variant of COMT, which is an enzyme that breaks down dopamine, in the prefrontal cortex, if they're slow to break down dopamine, then they can be too revved up or over-methylated. When you add methylated B12 and methylfolate. So my approach is to look at comp, you know, is it underactive or overactive? And that plays into, will I recommend a cofactor or a group of cofactors of B vitamins? Pulsing it, you know, is an option where you don't take it every day, but it's maybe once a week. And when they're starting to get anxious, maybe back off. And just making sure that, you know, that P5P or active B6 is a part of the puzzle when you're adding folic acid. And, you know, honestly, if someone does have, if they are underactive and breaking down dopamine and they have too much in the prefrontal cortex, I might not even start. I often don't start with that approach. I look at, like, what is their diet, you know, like? Are they eating, you know, plenty of fruits and vegetables? You know, is there any gut dysbiosis? Because our foods really are the biggest factor, from my perspective, in the inner workings of methylation. Mm-hmm. So making sure that you have a super clean diet. If you have a wheat intolerance or gluten intolerance, that's being addressed. You're not eating inflaming foods like sugar. So those, you know, starting there is often the best approach in my mind.
And when you say a fast, this is the part that always kind of confuses me a little bit when we talk about like fast or slow, like a COMT, I call it COMT, COMT gene, or SNP. When you're looking at your genetic test, is that like the plus plus, the plus minus, the minus minus,
yeah.
Or is that in a...
So... you know, if someone has a variant, it's considered MET, methionine, where it's, I'm pretty sure that would be plus plus, that they are over or they're underactive in breaking down. So there's an underactive COMT, which means too much dopamine, mm-hmm. which can lend to some mental health conditions.
Sure.
Factors are like anxiety.
Yeah. I think that's where a lot of, I hate to use the word, but amateurs kind of get tripped up too, because they go, well, I need to have more dopamine. And so they do things to get more dopamine. And it's like you said, that can really work against you.
Yeah. Yeah. And so people who have, you know, MET with COMT, they're wired and tired. So they might have too much ability to focus in, but they might look very ADHD, and they could have ADHD. I mean, some facet of ADHD. But they're probably not a good candidate for stimulation.
Right, because it would upregulate too much dopamine.
Correct.
And it could really drive them crazy.
yeah, definitely. And but when someone has MET, it doesn't mean they're anxious. It could mean that they just have wonderful executive functioning ability.
Yeah.
You know, they might have a very good memory. So it doesn't mean you have a certain condition. It just means that there could be a vulnerability there if other conditions are in place. And that's the beauty of genetics is, you know, there's genetics and there's epigenetics. There's our genes and then there's the expression of our genes. And that's 75% of it.
Yeah. Do you find then there's a connection between, because I've been really interested in how the liver, how detox works in the body affecting the brain. So if you see somebody is for lack of a better term, but a fast or slow metabolizer, that can affect how their mind works as well?
That's a really good question. I don't know if, you know, the PharmD or the scientists have made that leap, you know, in terms of the meta-analysis they've done. But I think that from my perspective, if you're a poor metabolizer of many different medications, and you're on, you know, some of these said medications, it could bog down the liver. So an herb like milk thistle is a wonderful liver cleanse. So maybe if, you know, they've been taking a medication for a long period of time, they didn't even know they were a poor metabolizer, I might recommend milk thistle over a short period of time to kind of help them detox. And I have found if someone is a poor metabolizer and the med has built up in their system, sometimes they can be even harder to get off a said medication. If they're not a good candidate for an SSRI medication, in tandem with that, and they've been on this said medication for a long period of time, they too can be harder to get off of that medication. And I've learned that over time by trial and error.
Wow. So typically if you find somebody who is not a good candidate for a, you know, through the genetic testing for a medication like an SSRI, is that when you start to kind of bring in more of the breath work, of the kind of more alternative therapies?
Well, yeah. So if someone's coming to me and they're on a medication and it's not working, you know, and then I do genetic testing and I say, well, you know, it might not be working because you have a gene that says it probably won't work well for you. So let's look at other options. So if someone is taking a medication, you know, and they want to get off of meds, that's one thing. We could work from there. But it might be a matter of changing to a different prescription and certainly doing some supportive work, just like with the B vitamins, you want to do the other cofactors, i.e. meditation and nutrition and, you know, looking at their jobs. Sometimes people are very unhappy in their jobs and it's like, well, you know, if you're at your job 10 hours a day and you're unhappy, we can do all this other stuff to support you. But it certainly doesn't solve the problem of you not living your best life and what you're meant to do.
I think that could come as a shock to a lot of people that for some people, it might not be a great idea to have so many B vitamins, because I think for a lot of people, it's like you said, you know, you need those cofactors, obviously for proper methylation. But if you're an overmethylator, for instance, you know, I think what I hear you saying is you don't want to be getting more of those cofactors. You maybe need to kind of take the gas off a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it's an art. Like, you know, if you started on this B vitamin and all of a sudden you're anxious and you weren't anxious before, maybe you need to back off on taking that supplement. You know, supplements need to be respected in the same way medications do, maybe to a lesser extent in terms of the side effect profile. But, you know, I mean, anything can help you can also hurt you, and you need to be judicious in terms of, you know, I don't feel better, I feel worse. And, you know, maybe you need to back off that methylfolate.
Yeah. I think just in the research I've done in the supplement industry, and really the whole reason why I've gotten so into this field of nootropics is because I see people over supplementing and using a lot of, we forget how powerful supplements are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's real interesting when you go look around the internet, when you look on Amazon, if you look on different supplement review sites, there's a lot of people who are failing with supplements. And, you know, that you'll see just this B vitamin complex, it didn't work for me, or this alpha GPC didn't work for me, or this thing didn't work for me. And they blame the supplement. A lot of times it comes down to, is your body built for this substance? I mean, that's what these are substances. They're chemicals, you know, we're being our own chemists, and sometimes the chemical explodes.
Yeah. And I think we live in a society where, take a pill, you know, and if, a supplement's a pill, you know, and we want quick fixes instead of looking at like, what is really going on for you? And, you know, mentioning the job, you know, I've had clients recently where, you know, they've changed their jobs and their, you know, their depression lifts. And is it the Lexapro? Is it, you know, the change in the job, or is it both? Is it, you know, prescribing maybe a medication that lifts their mood and they're able to see, you know, have more of an illuminated look at their life and say, well, you know, this isn't for me. This isn't a resonance anymore. You know, I feel good. I don't want to go to a job that I don't feel good in, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, I think functional, I'm definitely a fan of integrative medicine, whatever you want to call it, functional medicine, which is, you know, I guess, an offshoot or looking at the underlying cause of the disease. I think anything can be too rote, you know, and I think to keep an open mind of like, how can I help this person sitting in front of me? You know, what do I have to offer? What's in my toolbox? Right. And I think, you know, and I'm speaking for myself, we can all get arrogant and think, you know, it's definitely your foods, or it's definitely, you know, this is the panacea. And, you know, I've had clients recently who've said, you know, you really, you know, you said this one thing to me and it really was like the biggest game changer, or that Reiki that you did on me, like really helped me so much. And it's like, wow, you know, it's the subtle things sometimes that can make a difference. And sometimes it's listening, just being connecting with someone when they're in that state of despair.
This functional medicine profession or thing, field, it's real interesting, because I do personally believe that at some point, hopefully sooner than later, I would imagine functional medicine should overtake allopathic medicine. You mm-hmm. know, it's one of those things that I lived in New York for a while, and I've seen a functional medicine doctor. I mean, you have to, it's not for everybody, because it's not affordable to everybody. It's a great approach where there's more testing, there's more evaluations, there's more time spent with the patient. But what I found was, at least in my experience, it was a lot of problem answer, and the answer was a supplement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you go in, you spend a lot of money for a functional medicine doctor, and then you get prescribed a whole bunch of supplements, and it's almost like, okay, well, great, I'm not getting the medication that I don't want, but now I've got a whole drawer full of supplements and I don't know which one does what. I don't know if it's working. And then if I want to go get tested again to see if the stuff's working in the first place, I got to spend all that money again. So I feel you on that.
Yeah. And I think, again, like you could have a functional medicine practitioner that tends to really practice more allopathically, and you could have an allopathic practitioner that tends to be more holistic than their, you know, than their counterpart. So I really think, again, you have to like, you know, be open to, you know, that, you know, because I think we can default back to allopathic medicine, you know, as functional medicine providers or functional medicine practices, using functional medicine practices. I also think that there's a resonance, again, and this is something that I really started to appreciate, that in some ways, I think that it would be a disservice for functional medicine to just overtake the allopathic community, because there are going to be people who really resonate better with allopathic medicine and that hierarchical top-down approach, just because of their stage in the healing process. Mm. There's an excellent book, The 12 Stages of Healing by Donnie Epstein. And he talks about the first stage of healing is a sense of helplessness. And a sense of, you know, just despair, that nothing can help me. And we need to meet that client there, you know, and, you know, just commiserate with them. Now, of course, that can become a cyclical sense of going nowhere, you know, but if it occurs, we need to meet the person where they're at. The next few stages of healing are more of an allopathic approach. If someone's in, let's say, stage, I think 1 to 3 at least, they need an allopathic provider to tell them what to do, because that's where they're at. And that's not necessarily bad or good. That's what they need. If they come to me, I'm not going to be able to help them, because I want more of a horizontal approach.
That makes sense. Yeah, I feel that as a doctor, it's good to have more tools in the tool belt, I guess is what I mean. And these are the doctors I saw when I was a kid, you know, who loaded me up with antibiotics for a sore throat that could have just been dealt with much better. That there's just other ways of dealing with things.
Yeah. And I love the quote by Maya Angelou, when you know better, you do better. You know, and I think we live in a very fear-based medical system. And I think that, you know, we're all in it in some ways, where it's a very litigious, you know, punitive approach to whatever is the the status quo, you know, what has been, you know, studied, even though some of the studies are biased, is the way that you have to practice. So, you know, I think there's some limits that at least from people's, you know, mind's eye in terms of how out there they can practice. And I think that we're all challenged with that because we're all working within a system of, you know, licensure and, you know, following evidence-based practices, which can, you know, I have definitely evolved, you know, in terms of looking at, you know, the NIH has some wonderful studies that support nutrition and non-traditional approaches. But, you know, there's definitely a thrust in our community to, you know, to follow certain guidelines. So I think some of it could be fear, which, you know, isn't always, you know, too far off, you know. But that being said, I love that you're talking about arrogance. And I think not just physicians, but I think nurse practitioners, I mean, and speak for myself, we can be arrogant and think like, you know, this med is bad, you know, like I have like a no benzo policy. But there are times, there's been a few times when, you know, it's, you know, made sense. I had a client who wasn't sleeping and she was ready to be hospitalized. And she said, you know, Xanax works in my family. And I was like, I don't prescribe Xanax. And so I prescribed a discrete amount for her. And, you know, she took it and she was able to sleep. And then she was able to get off of it. And there was no addiction. And, you know, it was definitely like a, you know, very specific case where I kind of segued off of my, you know, my exception. But to just realize that sometimes, you know, we make exceptions. And when we say never, then that next client will come in and prove us wrong.
Right. That's so interesting. Yeah. And then, you know, you yourself, I mean, you have so many different modalities you work with, which is, I would imagine for many patients, a breath of fresh air. You know, you're not just stuck in one thing. You know, you start with the breath work, you work through with the meditation, the Phoenix Rising yoga, and then you even do Reiki, which is, I'm not very familiar with. How does that work in your practice?
Yeah. So Reiki was developed by a man named Dr. Yuzui, who is Japanese. And it basically is using with a universal life principle of being tapped into you know, God energy or universal energy, so to speak, and you're just a conduit of healing. And, you know, once you're trained, it's just a matter of laying on hands and just allowing the flow of energy through the person's, you know, system and opening up the energetic body, the chakras for healing. And, you know, fortunately, Reiki is acknowledged by the nursing profession as a, you know, a healing modality. So I'm fortunate for that.
Yeah, that's amazing. The chakras are so powerful when you start. I don't know if I've really fully been able to open them up per se, but focusing on just slight different practices. I mean, you will gain benefit. Everybody reacts differently to it. And I think if you have an open mind to it, of course you can see plenty of benefits.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, with our chakras, you know, they're dynamic. They're ever changing. It's when they become fixed and there's, you know, issues with, you know, our energy field that is longstanding, that's where disease can start to set in. So if we can treat something initially from an energetic perspective, it won't get into the dense body. So it's working with a subtle body. And often you have to hit that first. But you can actually, I have had very sick clients who've benefited from Reiki. So it's kind of a neat thing.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, we've hit on so many interesting aspects of your practice and healthcare. I think people listening to this, you know, if nothing else, will get a sense that there's so many ways to approach an issue or approach a problem, especially in mental health. You know, I think above anything else, whatever modality it is, we always honor the mind-body connection. And when you start to approach mental health from that aspect, I think the possibilities of healing are so much more viable.
Yes. Yeah. It's been wonderful chatting with you because it's it allows me to kind of to just kind of think about where I've come from and, you know, and even where I want to go with my own practice.
That's great. So speaking of your practice online, is there anywhere that listeners or viewers of the video can find you if they'd like to work with you? Do you work with people remotely, or are you only in work with people in Asheville?
Yeah, I don't work with people remotely from a nurse practitioner perspective. I certainly could work with people remotely doing healing and, you know, energetic work, and I'd be glad to do that. I have a website. It's Asheville Whole, H-O-L, Health, H-E-A-L-T-H.com. And, you know, I'd love to hear from your viewers.
We'll link to your website. And then you also have another website.
Yogablog.co.
Yogablog.co. Okay.
In my spare time, I do blogging and writing. And that's one of my ways of self-care. So yeah, if people want to check out some of my work that I've written on yogablog.co, feel free. And I also have some articles on Elephant Journal, you know, if they want to check those out too.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, definitely if you want to check out more of Kristen's work, go check out her websites, check out her blogs. And if you're interested in her energy healing, work with her remotely. Or if you're in the North Carolina, Asheville area, go to her practice. And sounds like you have some amazing ways of helping people heal emotionally, mentally, physically. And I hope your practice grows and you get lots of good feedback from this.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thanks for listening. For more brain boosting info, in-depth articles, and show notes, check out holisticnootropics.com.